from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, the upcoming feature film Kill the Messenger tells the story of Gary Webb, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. In 1996, Webb published a series of articles that later became part of the book Dark Alliance, which investigated the alleged link between the CIA, the Contras in Nicaragua, and the crack cocaine epidemic in South Los Angeles. Film director Michael Cuesta will join us to discuss the film, the controversy over Webb's reporting, which ended his career, and Gary Webb's 2004 suicide. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And Michael Cuesta joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. He's a director and producer of films as well as a number of TV series, including Dexter, Blue Bloods, 6 Feet Under, and Homeland. He directed the soon-to-be-released feature film Kill the Messenger, which will be out next month. It's based on the story, many of you remember, of San Jose Mercury News investigative award-winning journalist Gary Webb. In 1996, Gary Webb actually exposed how the United States Central Intelligence Agency sold crack cocaine during the Reagan administration in the ghettos of Los Angeles to support the proxy war of the Contras in Nicaragua against the Sandinistas. We welcome Michael Cuesta to this morning's second Forum Hour. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, where do we begin? Actually, let's talk about the title of this, because it comes from a book by the same title.
Yeah, it's the book by Nick Scow. Mm-hmm.
And what drew you to the story? Why did you want to do this?
Well, I was the last one to come on board. It was obviously, you know, it starts all with Gary's book, Dark Alliance, which I think was published in 1999 or 2000. And then Nick Scow's book, Kill the Messenger. Then it was developed with Universal Studios, adapted by Peter Landesman around 2007. And it was put into turnaround, because I guess journalist movies weren't doing very well at the time. So they sort of shelved it. And then when I think Jeremy Renner, who's the star of the film, played Gary, came on board, it gave it life again. And then they brought me in. And I was the last one to come. So I, you know, my representative sent it to me. And I did remember the story. You know, when I read it, I do remember this. But I didn't know the extent of how he was discredited and ultimately what happened after that. So I just started reading up a lot on it and really just sort of connected to him and his journey. And I started to dig into who he was as a guy, and that's sort of what
pretty complicated guy. I mean, I knew him slightly.
Yeah.
And,
in
fact, there's an interview I did with him back in 1998 after the release of the book Dark Alliance, mm-hmm. the CIA, the Contras, and crack cocaine explosion. And I asked him about the intense criticism that he got about his reporting on the issue and being labeled a conspiracist, and here's what he said.
I've noticed this in the last few years specifically, that anybody that raises anything that's sort of contrary to the official version of what happened is immediately labeled a conspiracy theorist and, you know, sort of marginalized and shunted off to the side. So it becomes very easy for people who sort of accept the official version of things and regard everybody else very suspiciously. And I have to say that happened in this case. I mean, and frankly, it's because of the topic matter, I think. And you talk about the CIA, you talk about covert operations, you talk about drugs, and everybody immediately, you know, sees spy versus spy, and it's hard to... Everybody's antenna goes up, everybody's emotions get very high, and it's sort of hard to talk rationally.
Well, he did talk about it rationally, though, as I recall the interview. But the fact of the matter is that there was a lot of conspiracy that was attributed to him. And some of this, you could talk about the discrediting of it, some of it falls on the major newspapers of the United States. I mean, especially the Los Angeles Times, but also the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Yeah, I mean, that's people were asking me, like, what is it about this movie that you discovered about the government? And I think what really brought why I wanted to get on board and what was sort of new, and not so much new, but I felt like the story had to get out, was that the tragic irony of this is that here was this really dedicated, great investigative journalist doing his job, and he was ultimately brought down by his own kind for doing his job, you know, big media. So it, in a way, the antagonist are the newspapers, not the, even though the story he wrote, it's the government, but the papers are the ones that discredited him. Of course, with, like, as we make a point in the film, and which was true, there were connections between some of the papers and relationships of the CIA. But I found that really fascinating.
Well, let's talk about the story. I mean, let's get it out there. There aren't all the my listeners who are familiar with what happened. It began with a kind of tip from a woman named Coral Baca, actually described often as all cleavage and lots of jewelry. And she was a girlfriend of a drug guy. And she called Gary, and that's how it all began.
Yeah. She called him, and Rafael Conejo is his trial. And she gave him a grand jury transcript that had proof of someone, Danilo Blandón, testifying that he was, you know, working for the government, and he was clearly involved with a bigger drug dealer than that. So Gary started to make the connections, you know, and to get a grand jury transcript is very rare, as, you know, we make a point in the movie that where he's like, I've only seen one of these in my life. And actually, that's what Gary said, that he may have said this on the show. And then he continued to dig and dig, and then
This gets into drug assets forfeiture too, right? Well,
pardon me?
This gets into the whole drug assets forfeiture.
The way this woman came to him was through his article, The Drug Forfeiture Program, which he actually changed the law. So she saw that this guy is a Doberman, man. He can, like, get things done. So she clearly, in a way, you know, manipulated Gary a little bit, and we made a point of that in the movie.
Yeah, the movie really told the story. You get the sense from watching the movie that you really sided with Webb, though. And I was sympathetic to Webb as well. As a journalist, I had a lot of respect for him and the journalistic work he did. His first editor, though, Scott Herbold, you may have come across this, did an article, and he said, well, he was passionate, but he was not fair. He kind of shoved the facts to the side. He inflated his stories. He shouldn't be seen as a hero and, moreover, needed editing constantly. Now, did you feel you wanted to present him as a hero?
I don't think it's so much about a hero. I mean, we lay out the story. He investigated the story. He put it together. I think you could get more in depth in the books, actually, but even in the film, we make it clear that he exposed a lot. They put it into the story. They printed it. Maybe they printed it a little too soon. They didn't package it properly. I think it's a result of not, you know, probably great editing either. So there were little mistakes that were made. Gary tried to come back and tried to cover them and tried to continue to investigate after the story was printed and after the Merck News actually wrote the apology letter, which was the thing that really sunk him because it destroyed all his credibility. And he didn't have a shot to get his stuff printed.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, he uncovered more after that, you know. And in the film, we make a point of him wanting to continue, but at that point, it's too late.
Yeah, I want to, again, illuminate for listeners what we're talking about here, about the issues of what was objected to by the Mercury News and what the apology said and why they backed off and what was vindicated and what wasn't. I mean, there are a lot of questions that still loom when you tell this story.
Yeah.
And we're getting into kind of the labyrinth and thick of it here.
Mm-hmm. But, well, look, I mean, they never got a CIA source on record.
Though he claimed he had them. Yeah.
Yeah. There were issues with the timeline. You know, and issues with transcripts and what was said at the trial and things like that. It gets very, very complicated. The movie had to do – if you see the movie, we did some streamlining of that.
You didn't do an Oliver Stone, though.
No. Oh, absolutely not. There's nothing like that. I mean, there are things, you know, like there's a trial where Gary's giving – Jeremy Renner playing Gary is giving notes to the lawyer so he can question the guy on the stand to get what he needs for his story. They actually had a conversation about that before the trial. We dramatized it by him actually feeding him notes. So things like that, we took it. But all of that happened. He was at that trial. And also we pulled some of the from Gary's story, some of the information from the earlier transcript from this one drug dealer that admitted to dealing with the Contras.
But the real incontrovertible fact here is that there was money being put into Nicaragua by the Contras, who were set up by this government
under the Reagan administration,
by the sale of crack cocaine. I mean, this was incontrovertible.
Yes. And the connection is from the drug dealers that were exiles here, Nicaraguan exiles after the revolution who came here. They were dealing the drugs. They were selling the cocaine. They were helping to get their country back. And they were putting the cocaine out in the streets. And a lot of that went, obviously, in the early 80s to Ricky. What they disputed was the timeline that
– Ricky Ross.
Freeway
Ricky.
Freeway Ricky Ross, the biggest crack dealer in
L.A.
In L.A., who has been accused of starting the crack epidemic. I mean, people, you know, actually think that's crap because, like, okay, maybe he started in L.A., not the whole country. But go ahead.
Well, no, I was just thinking about how you lay it out very well, and you show John Kerry later on, you know, saying, in effect, there was no doubt about this, mm-hmm. and it was terrible that this journalist's integrity was sullied mm-hmm. and all the rest of that. But the fact of the matter is, you get into the whole question of intentional addiction. I mean, that and the CIA informants and whether or not the CIA informants were actual or whether or not there was intention to actually, like Maxine Waters and all these representatives going on camera and saying
Gary didn't believe that. Gary didn't report that.
But that was pretty much attributed to him.
No, it was because of the spin. It got out of control, and Gary lost control of that. And and we make a point of that in the movie. And that's something that he was like not happy about. I don't know if he talked about it on the show, but the idea of intentionally, I never said that. The story doesn't purport that. You know, it's just that they were in business with these people, and they were looking the other way, and they allowed them to raise money for their war however they can. But they didn't, in terms of intentionally addicting or intentionally targeting a certain neighborhood. Gary, the story or the movie doesn't even report that. But that's part of the discredit. You know, you spin it.
But what was disputed?
If you got Dan Rather saying that, like, how? Go ahead.
No, just, you were talking about what was disputed by the newspaper. So let's get that out, too, in terms of what Webb wrote or didn't write.
Yeah, he did not write that the CIA intentionally addicted, you know, African-Americans, you know, and it was spun like that. And, you know, all the people that wrote the disparaging, you know, basically trying to poke holes in his story, the other papers, Washington Post, mostly the Washington Times went after him. I forget the journalist at the Washington Times, but used the word intentionally.
Washington Times, Washington Post, you mean? Was it Washington Times or the Washington
Post? No, there was the Times.
It was
the Washington Times.
But you said intentionally again?
No, these papers, Soros. Walter Pincus and Robert Soros wrote the article that was really disparaging of his article going after it. But the Washington Times is the one that wrote that Webb was – his allegations were that they were – the CIA intentionally addicted the black community.
Reverend Moon's newspaper at the time, I think.
Who was it?
Reverend Moon.
Yes, exactly.
It was Moon.
Yeah. I forget the man's name, but the journalist's name. But, you know, they played also the black paranoia card. You know, that this is just black paranoia and all that. So it really blew. I think Gary was shocked how big it blew up. I mean, he was here. I don't know if he talked about that. But
well, I remember the CIA confirmed it a couple of years later, but he was banished. I mean, he was essentially treated as a pariah.
You know, it's half vindication, because if you read the reports, it's like they admit to some relationships, but they never admit to the people that Gary had in his story. Those names are never mentioned. Obviously, Freeway Ricky Ross is never mentioned. They actually denied those parts. I don't know if Gary talked about it, but there was a report signed into as a result of the Senate hearings that came out from the two reports that the CIA released after Gary's stories came out. There was a report signed into order, an executive order signed into order in the early 80s by Reagan, allowing the CIA not to report dealings with drug dealers in Central America during that time to the Department of Justice. So it was an agreement between William Casey and the Attorney General at the time.
This is a period when the Iran-Contra was going on.
Yeah,
there were all kinds of deals.
I'm saying is the report was declassified as a result of Gary's reporting. And I guess what I'm getting to is, like, there's vindication too. Like, he actually did something. Despite the fact that he was discredited and everything, and it's tragic, I like to think, you know, at least the movie does purport a bit to empower that we need these guys, you know. We need the guys like Gary to just dig and dig and not take no for an answer. And you know what? You can never prove it. It's the CIA. That's one of the things. He never could prove it. But he did make connections, and we have to know that. And we have to ask those questions, and that's what that town hall meeting is all about.
Well, this is very different than, you know, when I think about work you've done, like on Blue Bloods and Dexter, and they actually wrote, I think, the pilot and the final episode of Homeland, a lot of fans of that show. This is a work that's much more, in some ways, historical, documentary-oriented. I mean, it's a great story, but mm-hmm. also it seems like you have some passion about this story now.
Well, I understood
as opposed to the movie you did about zombies. I guess you didn't have much passion about it.
No, it was a TV pilot. Well, my first film, L.I.E., was sort of a very controversial subject. So I was looking, well, not that I'm looking for a controversial subject, but I do like to explore things that aren't easy and things that are complicated. But I the more I read about it and even talking to Gary's wife, Sue, you know, I started to really connect to this guy and I started to relate to him, his passion and his, and so for me as a filmmaker, I was always coming from his point of view and his, why he was the way he was and his passion. So that makes him a universal, you know, empathetic character.
Did you try to talk to people like Don Garcia or David Yarnold or Jerry Sapos?
No.
I mean, all these people who were in this story because of the San Jose Mercury News being this, getting flogged by...
Nick in the book did. There's a lot of Don and Jerry in the book, mostly Don.
Yeah, these are all editors, I should explain.
Yeah, they're Gary's editors. Yeah. Don and Jerry were Gary's editors during that period. No, I didn't. I did not.
So the source was mainly the book.
The book, Gary's book, Dark Alliance,
yeah,
which is a big one. I also dug into other stuff. I dug into whatever I could. Robert Parry has written a lot about it. The NAP reporter. I don't know if you've heard of him, Robert Parry.
No, who he is, yeah.
There's a great book called Whiteout. So I just dug in that way and stuff like that. And then talking to his wife.
Well, the story, it's not only a story about journalism and somebody who was a dedicated journalist and who was in many ways hurt by his own journalistic establishment. I mean, San Jose Mercury News was not on the map like the LA Times, and that was part of the competition, as you portray in the movie. But there's also the fact that he posted a lot of this story. It kind of changed the nature of journalism. I mean, that was early on in terms of posting things online.
Yeah, they were the first ones. And he felt, and that was Gary's idea. I don't know if, again, you've met the man. I'm like, wow, you've met him. I don't know if you talked about it. They were the first ones to do it because it was his idea. He felt the story had, I mean, he knew. He was, and I used it in the film where there was slight apprehensiveness from him. You know, he knew it was a high unbelievability factor. He sort of knew what he was getting into. And putting it up online was kind of genius. And posting all the links to sources so he would allow the reader into his notebook or something so they could even dig deeper into the files and all the stuff where he got his information from. I think that is one of the reasons why the story spread like wildfire as well, you know.
Well, when he died, and it was suicide, I don't know if you have any doubts about it being a suicide, but there were a lot of people who posted online, you know, he was killed by the CIA and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Do you believe it was a suicide?
Well, let's be clear. I mean, you spoke with him in 98. 99, his book was released. Went on book tours. I mean, after that, his life, things didn't work out that well. He couldn't really get paid as a journalist after that.
He was in Cupertino doing, you know, stories.
For a while,
like,
but then
like
he left.
Local stories.
Yeah, well, that's, we portrayed that in the movie. But that was at the level he was working, other than his book. And then he had some screenplays and things like that. But it went on, it went up to 2004. And, you know, I think he grew apart from his wife. And he suffered from depression. And by 2004, he sent letters to his family, and he planned it, and it's really sad.
I like what you do with the family in the movie, because he was clearly a family man. In fact, there's even some real celluloid from family movies and stuff that comes in later at the end. But, you know, he was obviously a dedicated father. He had a relationship with his son that was in some ways really quite poignantly revealed throughout the movie. Father-son conflicts, particularly when some stuff in his past came out about what he'd done in Cleveland. Let's hear, actually, I think we have a clip from the movie. This is a trailer.
Gary Webb, San Jose Mercury News.
You believe in conspiracy theories, Gary?
No, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. Conspiracies, yes. If I believe it, there's nothing theory about it.
Was the government aware that you were smuggling tons of cocaine into the United States?
Yes, the government knew.
This leads to very sensitive national security matters.
National security and crack cocaine, the same sentence. Does that not sound strange to you?
I'm going to tell you the whole truth. I'm going to introduce you to people you should talk to.
And then you will be faced with the most important decision of your life.
Oh yeah, what's that?
Deciding whether to share it or not.
A lot of editing. A lot of editing?
A lot of editing?
Yeah.
In
that was just a trailer.
That
I
was a trailer.
I wonder when you put a trailer like that out, do you have to kind of
Put that trailer together. That was the studio. I wish we had a clip, you know, of because it turns it into sort of more, you know, like a thriller or come see this movie.
It is a thriller, though. I mean,
no, of course. No. I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. It's like I'm not knocking the commercial. It's a movie trailer, you know.
I'm going to actually ask
because
you,
my scenes, they don't play like that at all. Yeah. Like they, in terms of the tone of the movie and the way I direct, it's not that. But
do you rather direct for the screen or for TV? Where
well,
do you
I've made five films, you know, and they've all been small, starting with LIE. And I did work with Jeremy. That's where we met on my second film called 12 and Holding. He played a supporting role. That's probably one of the reasons why I did this film because of or was able to get it because a lot of people wanted to.
He's a big
come
name
on board. Yeah, yeah, and he really supported me on it. And I think we're a very good team. I'm making films as a director's medium. I mean, I've done co-writing on my own pilots, so that's more of a writer's medium. I prefer making films, but doing TV pilots isn't bad because you get in there and you shape the whole tone and the look and the whole rhythm of the storytelling of the piece for a pilot. But to continue with it, it's not as interesting.
The Homeland was a great pilot. I mean, well, that was to you for that. I mean, because it really hooked people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it had a great, great central premise too.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's what, you know, if you take the bipolarness out of it, it could almost be 24. So Jack Bauer, you know, on
no, there were people who were actually upset about the way bipolar was portrayed in that. Did you get a lot of flack on that? Or I'm talking about Claire Danes' role as Carrie.
Well, it's funny because Claire and I and Alex Ganza, one of the writers of the pilot and the showrunner, we all read, we did our research on it, you know.
And it was from an Israeli production, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is, but there's no bipolar thing in that. It's loosely based on Hatafim, the prisoner of war Israeli show. I don't recall any. I didn't have to go through that. Maybe Claire and Alex press-wise had to sort of deal with that and have these kinds of one-on-one situations and people calling in. But, you know, with Claire, it was always about trying to be as honest to it as possible. I think what's not believable is that the CIA would have kicked her out by episode two. Yeah.
suspend a lot of disbelief.
No,
on that,
of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're dealing with television and it's sort of like it's a more introspective, smarter 24.
Because you have to think about Mandy Patinkin and Claire Danes running the CIA because that's...
I mean, as soon as they do something called boxing, the CIA, where like they could pull you at any time and blood test you and drug test you, they find that you're out.
Let me do this. We're talking to Michael Cuesta. He is the director of Kill the Messenger, also executive producer of Showtime's Homeland, which we just touched on, and Kill the Messenger opens in theaters October 10th, talking about the Gary Webb case. And it still, I know, well, stays in the hearts and minds of many people. Whole idea of crack cocaine being sold actually to support the Contras, which were created by the Reagan administration in the first place to fight in Nicaragua against the Sandinistas, and then how that story, that sad story of his being defamed and being essentially pilloried, went down. You may have questions about it. You may have thoughts about it. You may want to join this conversation. And to do that, you can call us toll-free, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls. Again, toll-free to join us now, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You can also go to our Facebook page. Again, we'll continue. We'll hear from you when we return. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Michael Cuesta, who is the director of Kill the Messenger, also executive producer of Showtime's Homeland, and he's worked on a lot of television and film in his day. Still a young man, but has a record that he's... Why are you making that face? What does that mean?
Not that young. No, I don't feel it this morning. I'm jet-lagged.
Well, you're running around promoting this film. By the way, the upcoming film, Kill the Messenger, actually tells the story of Gary Webb, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. And as many listeners may recall, in 1996, he published a series of articles that later became part of a book called Dark Alliance that investigated the alleged link between the CIA, the Contras in Nicaragua, and the crack cocaine epidemic in South Los Angeles. And we're talking about that film, talking about Well, Gary Webb, in the case of Gary Webb and what it all means, particularly today as we look back on it, the film brings it back to life. Again, we do welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. Particularly like to hear from some of you who have some thoughts about the Gary Webb case or some memories about it. And you can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Let me go right to your calls. And Scott, we'll begin with you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. If I was Gary's editor and he came to me before sharing any of this, I would ask the question, how do you feel confidently about going up against the CIA as a single messenger? Why not put four or five messengers together? Because it's much more difficult to kill multiple messengers. So my question is, did he have other co-journalists working on this with him, and did they refuse to put their names on the publish? But it seems so easy to discredit one person or to squash just one person. And I don't know if that makes sense, but I'll take it off the air.
Sure.
Okay,
no, he had a guy that, well, he had someone down in Nicaragua working with him when he went to see Norman Meneses. So that was one that I know of. But after the story was printed, and I believe he's Peter Carey, I think he still works for the Merck. I know my production designer spoke with him when we were in pre-production, and Pete was pretty, you know, supportive of the film. And a good friend of Gary's, he did some follow-up work, a lot of follow-up work, and found contradictory information. And that was one of the things that didn't help Gary's case either.
And that's in
one
the
of
film.
The thi- pardon me?
That's in the film.
It's in the film. Yeah. Now, we, in terms of what he digs up, we had to play with it because it just wasn't dramatic, the things that he found out. And you know, what I didn't want to do in the film is to bring a complete hole in Gary's story and present that, and then the movie just becomes about a guy who got it wrong. Because the fact is, and people could take it like that, the fact is he didn't get it wrong. He just couldn't prove it, as I said earlier.
But the movie portrays him as having people who revealed things to him, especially people who had CIA connections.
Yeah, well, that's how it happened. Alava also came through transcripts, too. I mean, you can't dramatize that. So.
But he couldn't name these people. He couldn't produce these people. That was part of the reason he was, you know, pretty much shellacked to a great degree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but a lot of it was the timing, which was very, I have to say, dramatically very confusing to try to illustrate where, well, in the guy's testimony, he said two things. He said, I was selling drugs for the Contras and I was dealing with Ricky, but wait a second. This is Blandone during his testimony. He lied. And then he said, well, I didn't meet Ricky until after I stopped with dealing with Norman Meneses, the Contras. So there was this time discrepancy. And all the other papers went for that. But in another testimony, he said a contradictory thing. But the papers all locked on to that one particular testimony. Yeah. And, you know, there were little things that went on between him and his editor where he, I don't know if Gary's, it's in the book.
So there's still a lot of questions. Really.
There's a lot of questions, but the fact is that he did make he connected a lot of dots. Did he connect them all? No. Did they print the story a little too soon? Maybe. But the fact is, he got some facts out, and it did make a difference. And as Gary said earlier, it's like conspiracy theories is someone that actually digs something up. You know, people are right away. You're a conspiracy theorist because you're saying those guys do these. You know, the CIA did some bad things. So right away they point. It's so easy to kill the messenger that way, you know. And we all know. I mean, it's not new news that the CIA has been involved with the drug trade. I mean, the complicity goes back to the Golden Triangle and even, you know, the beginning of the CIA.
Let me bring another caller on. We go to San Jose. Charles, you're on. Morning.
Yes. Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Michaels. Actually, I carry in my wallet a card that attests to the fact that I voluntarily gave 6 years of my life to defending the Constitution of this United States and thereby our country and its freedoms. And I want to thank the director for making this movie that tells the story that many of us who lived in Los Angeles during that time knew to be true. There was a saying in the community, that the White House was the crack house. And a lot of people who were in support of Reagan and others in his administrations just went apoplectic when they heard that. But the reality is, unfortunately, that we can be presented with the truth. The director said he couldn't connect all of the dots. Of course he couldn't, because it's set up that way. Many of us who know, let me back up, we forgive me. Unfortunately, we won't believe the truth if the truth conflicts with our fantasy. And that's much the case in Gary's situation. I mourn the fact that he allegedly committed suicide, but it takes heroes like him to continue to shine light on the fact that everything that we would like to believe about our country is not really true.
All right, Charles, thank you.
Appreciate you. I like to think, as far as the suicide and all of that and being hero, I mean, he was taken down by the discrediting. That's what killed him. You know, that was his death. It was his the death of him being.
And the fact that he couldn't be a journalist.
He couldn't be a journalist. Yeah. It destroyed his career. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I didn't really focus on it in the film. But, you know, you were asking me, you were saying someone earlier said that he that Gary, you know, was no, you know, wasn't a hero. He was a flawed guy. But as this gentleman was saying, like, if he's a hero to some people, that's okay. You know what I mean? If he means something, and I think that that's okay.
What about the film and the necessity to fictionalize? And I mean, how much is based on reporting and fact? And I mean, you've got composite characters. You have to change the timeline. You have to get rid of stuff that's going to bore your listeners. So you have to do a kind of whole congeries of magic tricks here, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I would. The biggest one. Well, one, the personal one was with. You know, and Sue, Gary's wife, was supportive of the script, and she knew what we were filming. And I think when she saw the movie, it was probably a little more raw. But what we did was a lot of Gary's issues that broke the straw that broke the camel's back, as you know, as far as, you know, now he's losing his job and now he's losing his family. The family, she was more sort of around during the Dark Alliance sort of debacle and when they turned on him. And then from about 98 to about 2000, it started to sort of come apart. So we, you know, dramatically brought that up into the film.
What happened to his son, do you know? Because, I mean, there, I remember reading part of his suicide letters. He just wanted his son to be dedicated to finding truth and helping people and doing the things he felt as a journalist he stood for and wanted to stand for.
What happened to his son? I'm not familiar with that. I mean,
because there's a lot in the story about father and son, and, you know, as I said, I was just curious about that. Maybe somebody knows out there and can let us know, because we're talking about a local hero to some, not hero to others. Here's Mark from Berkeley who writes, while the CIA may not have been specifically targeting black inner-city citizens in enabling drug sales, you must not disregard the de facto targeting that was implicit. Who did they think crack cocaine was going to be sold to? It's probably how they justified the harm they knew must come of their project. As one of the gangsters in The Godfather says, when allowing drug sales to the coloreds, quote-unquote, they're animals anyway, so let them lose their souls.
I could imagine those conversations go on, you know? I mean, it's the people who know the most who care the least, right? Gary never purported that. We have no proof of any sort of intentional things like that. But as far as back room conversations like that, I'm sure they go on somehow.
Start an epidemic?
No, not so much. Let's start an epidemic. So, yes.
Were there any consequences that you know of to his story? Any people in positions of power who were discredited or fired or any legal consequences?
I'm sorry.
I just wondered if you knew, because I don't know the answer to this, were there any consequences to the work he did in Dark Alliance? Any people in positions of power who were discredited legal consequences?
John Deutsch stepped down a month later, you know, after his appearance in South Central. I think his tenure was plagued with controversy, and I don't think this helped. So if the article never came out, would have Deutsch been around for longer? Good chance.
Who knows? Robin writes, way overdue story. Looking forward to it, and we'll look forward to more of your calls. We'll go next to you. Emma, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes. Hi. I was very impressed with this forum. I listened to you guys for a long time. Between the two stories, the Ebola story and your story with the journalist, hits the nail on this systemic pathology from within. In the Ebola story, the UCSF scientists very clearly educated us about the difference between the droplet and the airborne, and how the health system itself gets destroyed from within if you don't make the move. And the same story here with the journalist. I mean, I'm very glad this film was made, and it's a kind of a common story, I think. When you go alone, it's very easy to kill the messenger. But it's such a fusion of two forums where the issues are horrendous. On one end, you have this political and the cocaine story, and then on the other end, you've got Ebola.
Well, that connection was not intentional. As you know from listening to us, we do different hours on different subjects. But, boy, Michael Cuesta?
There's controversy in all these subjects.
He's using that as a metaphor, that in a way, journalism and Ebola are killing the messenger.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's interesting. I haven't been following the Ebola story so much. So,
well, I thank you for the call, Emma. Yeah. I appreciate hearing from you, and we'll hear next from Alberto. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I grew up in the Nicaraguan community in San Francisco, and it's a close-knit community, and we all know folks who have been impacted by either dealing drugs or getting addicted to cocaine during the time period that Gary described in this story. And we also know folks who were on either side of the political conflict between Sandinistas and Contras. And so we were all very much impacted. So when this story came out, it was really important to get this story out. And it had an impact on me also as an American, watching the Iran-Contra hearings, watching folks in my government being convicted of crimes and then pardoning each other, pardoning themselves for these crimes. It had a great impact on my faith in the U.S. government, unfortunately. But it's an important story, so I'm really thankful that it's coming out again in another form that's more accessible to folks, because I think folks really need to understand this story to also understand the legacy of the Bush family and the legacy of Ronald Reagan, who now is trumpeted as a hero just because he's dead. So I wanted to thank you for sharing this story in a format that's much more accessible to the American public, who's unfortunately not likely to pick up a book.
Alberto, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. Actually, got a tweet here from a listener. It says, what possible difference should it make if causing addiction was intentional or not? It was a horrendous betrayal regardless. And the fact is, this was the genesis of the crack cocaine epidemic, any way you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. I mean, all of the cocaine that came in that time, they figured out how to turn it into crack. And in terms of how it all happened, Gary made a connection that, yes, our own government was involved in this and using that money of those sales to help them fund their war, because Reagan lost his funding in the early 80s. I mean, as far as intentional, I think that it doesn't matter. It happened, but that was the way they went after him, and it wasn't fair. To say that this reporter's, putting in a crack pipe over a CIA logo and said they cooked it in their basement. If you're not the careful reader, I guess, of the article or all the deals, if you see the package of it, it comes off like that.
Well, you heard the caller who said they were saying the White House was a crack house.
I mean, exactly. That's
taking it a little bit hyperbolic to put it mildly.
Well, like I just said, like they're cooking it in the basement. Yeah. Like they're creating it. And they're still responsible, man. If they're involved, if you and I were involved with dealers like that, but we didn't know that they were doing this and we're turning the other way, and you're still responsible for it. there was a book called The Unlikely Ones about a German, you know, The Unlikely Ones, it was an SS officer, right from the point of view of an SS officer. And he talked about that. It's like, well, I only, you know, I was in the crematorium. I only like opened the middle hallway door. So culpability, you know, it's like I didn't, it wasn't my idea. Yeah, but you're, you know, the right thing to do is to go report it or to not do it, you know.
Here's James who writes, my father was interviewed by Gary Webb. He was an ex-CIA and Nicaraguan, and he purposely deceived Gary. My father was all about plausible deniability, and it's unfortunate how CIA can operate with basic immunity. Sam writes, there's something profoundly dystopian and Orwellian about what happened to Webb. He exposed the true conspiracy when it was actually politically relevant, yet he was discredited and his career and life destroyed. It's sad to think that he committed suicide while the political elites of our country were able to escape without being held responsible for these policies. The same people who were supporting drug-smuggling terrorists in the 80s continue to operate in Washington as if nothing happened, starting wars to fight terrorism and drug smuggling. I think we should remember the story of Webb as well as the story of the Gulf of Tonkin whenever a conspiratorial story emerges which embarrasses our government. Most conspiracy theories are false, but we should not let cynical people in our government exploit that to hide its human rights abuses. Another listener says, what is sad is that Mr. Webb sacrificed his life for his story, and the CIA is probably still smuggling drugs for money. Even the U.S. military allowed Afghanis to grow poppy seeds for heroin because it was their economy. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of, you know,
this
good.
Where's all this coming from? This
from my listeners.
Oh, wow.
It's piling the best listeners in. The planet.
Fantastic.
You know, thoughtful people. Very.
Yeah, I hope some of these listeners they talk about have they seen the film at a screening or they're just like
no.
They're just going from the subject
they're
of
just
us
going
talking.
From the subject.
Right.
Yeah, but they'll see the film. I saw the film. I liked the film, and I'll give it an endorsement.
Yeah, I mean, I hope. Like, I read a lukewarm review of the film, and it was like it's not a great film, but a necessary one.
You shouldn't read those reviews.
Yeah, no, sometimes it's hard. You open up your email, and there it is. You know, but the fact is, a necessary one is a compliment, you know, to me, and a good thing. So that means you have to see it.
Let me get another caller on. Milton, join us. You're on.
Yeah, hi. This is an altogether unexpected question for Michael Cuesta. You quickly used the word showrunner. Now, lately I've been hearing any number of actors on actresses, some on forum, mostly on Fresh Air. I have no idea, and probably very few listeners know what a showrunner is. Tell us what it is.
Well, they keep them in Hollywood. They keep them on ice, and then when they need them, no, I'm kidding. A showrunner is usually some of the time the person that wrote the pilot, and they call it created the pilot, and then that person is offered the job to then, once the pilot is picked up and they order the series and start ordering scripts, is to be the chief or to run the writer's room. To oversee, say, 4 to 5 other writers, and they continue to write with them. So they become sort of the auteur, like a what's his name? Matt Weiner of Mad Men, someone like that. They become sort of the auteur of the show. And then there are also other cases where, you know, somebody may create the show, the concept, and then leave the show, and then they hire a writer that's available to come in to be the showrunner, the guy that runs the writer's room. Sometimes they bring in people like me because I've co-written things, but my shows, the ones I've written, haven't been picked up, so I hadn't had a chance to do that showrunning thing. But I've partnered with showrunners, and I've become like an executive producer, director, so I run the filmmaking aspect of it. And I did that on Homeland and Dexter.
Let me thank the caller. You have much more investment in a film like this than, say, doing a Homeland episode or a Dexter episode emotionally and personally?
Absolutely. No comparison? There's no comparison. I've only made, before Kill the Messenger, I've made 4 other films. And there were small movies, and they were movies that I mostly had Final Cut on. On this one, I didn't. You know, I worked with my producers at my studio. But it takes a long time, you know, to do a movie. So my feeling is if you're going to spend a year and a half, 2 years of your life on something, you know, you better love it. So, and I'm lucky enough to also make a living from television. So I do, I'm a little pickier on my film subject matter.
Let me go to another caller. Steve, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I worked at the Mercury News at the time Dark Alliance was published, and I'd like to offer a very different viewpoint of all this. Almost everything about the legend of Dark Alliance and Gary is really has been misconstrued and overblown, from the story itself to the tragic circumstances of Gary's death. I only met Gary one time at an awards banquet at which he was receiving an award for Dark Alliance, and he seemed like a good guy. He was like many investigative reporters. I think he did some fabulously good reporting in Dark Alliance, but he also overreached in profound ways in his reporting and in his connecting of the dots. Good investigative reporters look for connections that sometimes aren't there, and they must be edited well. And so while it should be said that Gary made a ton of mistakes in the execution of Dark Alliance, his editors made graver mistakes in failing to...
But forgive me, Steve, what was the overreach as you see it?
Well, the fact that you've had, what, four callers or callers and email people respond and say that they imagine government complicity in the spread of crack cocaine. I was in charge of race and demographics coverage at the Mercury News at the time it was published, and I could see that it was clear that what the Mercury News had done was going to create this impression that the government had intentionally introduced crack cocaine into Los Angeles and America. And so when...
So excuse me, Steve, maybe they should have apologized for bad editing as well.
They certainly should, and that was never really... You know, the Mercury News didn't punish Gary. Au contraire, they really defended him far too long. But the notion that the other newspapers were all piling on out of jealousy, the three major newspaper responses were very different. But the Washington Post story, which was the first of the three, was quite courageous because they recognized that in the black community in D.C., the notion that the CIA was somehow responsible for the spread of crack cocaine had become so widespread that they had to respond to it. And so they did, I thought, a very sober, very well-reported story that put this in perspective. This was a profound failure of the Mercury News in editing, but...
Well, I'm glad you're seeing that. You're acknowledging that. You know, the failure on the editing.
Yeah, Steve, I appreciate hearing from you, and thank you for offering your perspective. Let me go to some more emails here. Jim writes, Michael, I have followed this issue since the '80s and have a very strong memory of Mr. Webb's stories. I actually stood up and cheered the first morning I saw it in the Mercury News. In the end, it is similar to the fate of Dan Rather vis-a-vis Bush's National Guard service. It was true, but he couldn't prove it. The hubbub over the minutiae of the story hides the bottom line that the public has never fully understood. Our government was deeply involved in smuggling drugs into this country at the very time that Nancy Reagan was wandering the country saying, just say no. If this isn't the most important story of the late 20th century, I'm not sure what is. Another listener says, this is Callie, writes, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who wrote the foreword to Dark Alliance, investigated Webb's work, which lead to the undeniable conclusion that the CIA, DEA, DIA, and FBI knew about drug trafficking in South Central Los Angeles. That's a quote from Maxine Waters. She was able to get Contra leader Adolfo Calero to admit he had a relationship with the CIA through the United States Embassy, where he directed USAID funds to community groups and organizations. She writes, again, quote, we all owe Gary Webb a debt of gratitude for his brave work, end of quote. And one of Webb's last stories was an expose of the U.S. Army's development of video games that simulate warfare and its use of them to recruit young warriors. Let me go another call, and we welcome Muhafin. Good morning.
Good morning. Michael, I'm very, very happy to be for you to be airing this interview. I'm a little bit disturbed about the air of skepticism in what the director of the movie, the interviewer, is saying, and the concept of the skepticism about whether this really happened, and the fact that you're not getting a lot of voices from the victims of this situation. And I want to talk about myself and my family as an African-American family in a thriving and growing neighborhood in East Palo Alto, where we can document that these drugs were introduced. We knew a state of the family. The families were connected in a community. and we were working toward shared goals, and we had high achieving and high development in the students, and they were academically oriented, and I lost two brothers in this spiraling down, the introduction of drugs, crack cocaine, heroin. I found out when I was 30 that my younger brother had had a heroin habit, hidden heroin habit, for 15 years, starting at the age of 15, spiraling off of that with the marijuana expose, and then the whole alcohol introduction in terms of what kids were doing in that area. And the government, I feel, capitalized on that. But the goal of it seemed to be the fracture and the destruction of our upwardly mobile families, moving ourselves into a status of citizenship and accomplishment that just didn't fit the status quo.
Mohafin, we're coming up to the end of this program, but I want to thank you for the call and bringing
That's a great call.
Your view into it and your experience. And thank you, Michael Cuesta. Good luck with the movie. The movie, again, is Kill the Messenger. Michael Cuesta is executive producer also of Showtime's Homeland. And Kill the Messenger opens in theaters October the 10th. We didn't get to a caller who wanted to say that the bipolar portrayals in Homeland actually helped him personally, the way they were depicted. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Supai. And we get online support from David Marks. Forum's senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.